Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guest, and in this case, the legendary Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who's probably most famous as a great beat poet in the time of Kerouac and Ginsberg, the proprietor of City Lights Books, City Lights Press. But before that, before being a beatnik, he was a good old American Boy Scout and a war hero during World War II, and many lives to discuss in the case of this American original. I started this interview when he was 93, and I keep waiting for another session, but, you know, he's 97. Let's run the interview we did back there in 2013.
I've known this guy for a long time. I don't know whether he's my intellectual father. He was my former boss at City Lights Books when I got drummed out of graduate school because I made the mistake of writing a book about U.S.-Cuban relations. The guy was kind enough to hire me for a buck and a quarter an hour, and I worked there, I think, for almost 3 years. Is where I got my education, and Ferlinghetti was a great boss, basically, because he didn't really care what I was doing. And I actually, you know, have to say, intellectually, I've been inspired by him his whole life. And then the L.A. Times gave him an award as the Western Writer Lifetime Achievement Award, one of his many awards. And at that time, we did a little film thing. And I was startled that there were all these things about Lawrence Ferlinghetti that I did not know, because among other things, he's incredibly shy and or modest. I don't know what the right word is. You were a naval officer in the Pacific during World War II, and you were there at the time when the atomic bombs were dropped, fat man and little boy, on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. When did you first go to the Pacific? What were you doing there?
Yeah, I was a navigator on a AKA troop transport with about 10,000 troops. And when we left the States and went through the Panama Canal, we thought we were going on to be an occupation force. When we were past Hawaii and headed for Japan, we found out that we weren't an attack force anymore. We were going to be an occupation force and didn't have to fight to get in there. So then we went in to Nagasaki. We went into a little town called Sasebo, about 3 hours from Nagasaki by train. So after a few days, we were able to go over to Nagasaki on the train and see the devastation. Well, we didn't know what atomic bombs were. No one did in those days. No one on board ship knew what an atomic bomb was. And I mean, in the Navy as in all other military establishments, they tell you just as much as you need to know to perform your part of your slaughter or whatever other murderous commands you've been given. And so we didn't know anything except we went ashore in the little town of Sasebo. There was no one there. The whole town was boarded up. There wasn't a Japanese in sight. And when we went over to Nagasaki, it was this total devastation. It was like a landscape in hell. You've heard this before from many people. What was left of bodies had all been cleared away by the time we got there, which was about 7 weeks after the bomb had been dropped. It was like a landscape on the moon. It was acres of mud with bones and hair sticking up out of it. And as I've said before, it really made me an instant pacifist. Up to that time, I'd been a good American boy in the Boy Scouts, etc. I'd been in the Normandy invasion. I'd been skipper of a subchaser in the Normandy invasion, but we didn't land. We were anti-submarine screen, and we could see the doughboys getting shot up on the beach. That was murder, but we didn't get close to it, really. And so Nagasaki really woke me up.
So let me ask you about your development. So you come back and you're still the Boy Scout and you've been the naval officer for 4 years. What happened? Is that when you went to Columbia? You had the GI Bill?
I went to Columbia and got an MA in English literature. And
you were living in the village?
Yeah, I was living in the village, 235 West 12th Street.
You lived on West 12th Street?
235 West 12th.
Because my father worked there at the New York Knitting Mills.
Really?
Yeah. Well, he worked at Little West 12th Street, which is now a big center of fashion and all that. All right. So you went up to Columbia and you got a master's.
And then I took off for France because I had a lot of French roots. I'd been in France as a very small child with my French aunt. When I was born, my mother already had four sons. My father died just before I was born, so she kind of had a total nervous breakup and couldn't take care of me when I was born, so she handed me off to a French aunt. But we lived in near Strasbourg, and I spoke French before English.
So how'd you happen to pick, so you were at Columbia, you got the master's, and what, you decided to then go on for a doctorate? And did the GI Bills cover that?
Yeah, but an American doctor was too restrictive and too academic, and you couldn't write a thesis on a live person, for instance. I don't know how it is these days, but... And I found that at the University of Paris, you could get a doctorate on living subjects or on living literature. And it was a totally creative degree. I went to Paris. I didn't know anyone there except at Columbia University. I'd been going around with Mary Whitman, who was the sister of George Whitman, who was in Paris. And when I took off for Paris, she gave me George's address, and he was living in the Quartier Latin. He was down in a third or fourth class hotel on the Boulevard Saint-Michel, and I went up to his room. He had a little room about 10 by 10 feet with books stacked up to the ceiling on all three walls, and George in the middle on an old broken down easy chair cooking his lunch over a can of Sterno. He didn't have a bookstore then, but about the time I left Paris, he started Shakespeare and Company. It was first called Librairie Mistral, and he changed it to Shakespeare and Company in 1962 or thereabouts.
That's when I went there at your suggestion, and it was on 33, if I recall correctly, 33 Rue de Boucherie?
37.
Oh, 37, I'm off.
Rue de la Boucherie.
Yeah, that's a dump.
Boucherie is a wood pile.
But, the store went straight up in the air.
Well, it was four stories.
Yeah, and I remember the bathroom never works. You had to pee in a can and throw it out the window. So much for the elegant French way of life. But I remember I showed up there with a recommendation from you, my boss at City Lights Books.
George was friendly?
Oh, yeah, friendly enough, but I still got dysentery and ended up in...
Well, he was my oldest and dearest friend, and he died about 5 years ago now.
Well, he's the inspiration for City Lights, right?
Well, yes, when I finally got my doctorate,
Dr. Lawrence Ferlinghetti. You know, by the way, when you first told me that, I thought, why don't people know that about you, that you have a doctorate from the Sorbonne, right?
Because I never went into teaching in the university.
Yeah, but still, here was the image of the beat poets. I know you don't think you were a beat, but still, untutored. And here you were, a doctorate from the Sorbonne. It's as good as it gets.
Well, that's a big false impression of a lot of the beats, because Allen Ginsberg was one of the most well-read, literate people on the literary scene. They were all heavy readers. Gregory Corso, Jack Kerouac, they were enormous readers, and they spoke, like Kerouac spoke French from childhood, and Allen could get by in Spanish and French and Italian, and they weren't illiterate in other languages. The first foreign trip I took as a poet was with Allen Ginsberg when we went to Chile in 1959. When we got there, we found out we had been invited by the Communist Party. It happens that we were invited by Fernando Alegria, who was a professor at University of California, Berkeley, but he had a brother in Chile who was secretary of the Communist Party, and that's how it happened. We happened to be invited by the Communist Party, and to serve the ends of the party, we were bused down to the mine head, a town called Lota on the coast of Chile, where it was time so that we would arrive. We were a busload of international literary figures. We arrived at the mine head just when the miners were coming up out of the ground in these cages. They've been down in the mines for we were told 12 hours. And they said, well, what do you think they get per day? And we said, we had no idea. They said they get a dollar a day. So what do you think of that? So then we all sounded off about that, and it got in all the newspapers. Right on. I mean, that was good political education right there.
So you and Ginsburg, and Julian, that was 59?
1959.
Yeah. And then you got involved, somehow there was in Cuba, there was a newspaper, Lunes de Revolucion.
Oh, yeah. By then, the beat poets had already been translated and published, or some of them had been published, including myself, in Lunes de Revolucion, the Monday literary supplement of Revolucion, the daily paper. And it was probably the best literary supplement published all over the Americas at that time. I went down there in 1959 because I was looking for my mother's family's roots. And my mother's was Sephardic Jewish, Portuguese Sephardic. And her family had fled the Spanish Inquisition. Their route to the New World was through St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands. The graveyard there is full of my mother's ancestors, my ancestors. And so I went down there trying to track down my ancestors.
This was after the revolution, which was January 59.
Yeah, so yeah. At that time it was perfectly legal to go to Cuba. So I was with my wife at that time. The only wife I had was Kirby Ferling Getty. And
I remember Kirby.
She died 2 years ago now. We're just getting a tombstone for her in the Druid Cemetery in Bolinas.
Hmm.
It's so typical of Bolinas.
It's a wonder they'll let her be buried there, you know. They don't like anybody coming and doing anything at Bolinas.
So we just stopped off in Cuba on the way back to the States. We were going to Cuba and then to New Orleans. We were staying in some waterfront hotel, and I was in a bar. I don't think it was Hemingway's bar. It was just a miscellaneous bar, and started talking to these young Cubans. Turned out they were poets, and they were editors on Lunes de Revolucion.
Ah.
And finally, I told them my name, and they said, oh, well, we published you. So and so everyone was very happy. Everyone's embracing everybody else. And so they said, would you like to meet Fidel? And I said, well, of course. The revolution had only been going 1 year.
Oh, so this was 60.
Late 59.
Castro entered Havana, I think, January 1st, 59, yeah.
Yeah. So they took me to this cafeteria where they said Fidel often ate. So sure enough, in the middle of the meal, this tall guy wearing fatigues and smoking a long cigar comes out of the kitchen. And I said to these young Cuban poets, isn't that Fidel? And they said, yes. And I said, well, how about introducing me? And they said, well, we don't know him. So it's like in this country, you know, you don't just go up and say you know some famous person, go right up and start talking to him. They said, we don't know him. So I got up and I walked over to him. He was totally unguarded. No one was with him. I said, soy amigo de Allen Ginsberg.
Amigo de Allen Ginsberg.
And so he got this silly grin on his face and he shook my hand. He'd met Ginsberg at the Hotel Lenox in New York. And
when he was plucking chickens.
He had a very, very soft handshake, which was surprising. And then he just waved and walked out and got in an open Jeep all by himself, no guards or anything, and drove off. This was in the first year of the revolution, which there was still this revolutionary euphoria. And he was a hero.
I remember because I visited Cuba the first year, actually the summer of 60. And I remember Lunes de Revolucion and the whole celebration of the beats. And it was interesting because the beats, they were anti-authoritarian. Well, Ginsberg was gay. The Cuban Revolution.
Yeah, and he got himself kicked out of Cuba for being gay.
Right. When was that?
I'm not sure. Maybe 63.
Yeah. You know, you had that tension in the beats, who are mostly thought of as love and peace and all that, which is really more the flower children revolution that came after and the hippies. But in the beats, and we've talked about this, the tension, say, I don't know if it came out as tension personally, but the different view of, say, an Allen Ginsberg and a Jack Kerouac. You know, Ginsberg died a committed leftist socialist pacifist, and Kerouac moved to what could be today thought of as a Tea Party person, right?
Oh, yeah. He moved further and further to the right.
Was that tension in evidence when you guys were running around North Beach?
Well, no, because that was in the 1950s. It was only after he became a confirmed alcoholic in the 1950s, but later he became totally lost in booze. And then his mind really degenerated, and that's when it went further and further right.
But was that... Those tendencies were implicit in a lot of the, I think is what you're saying about D.H. Lawrence. There was, you know, on the one hand, an embrace of individual freedom. On the other hand, a certain respect for authority or what? Or power, or maybe even a racist white view?
Well, Kerouac was a Catholic. He believed in the baby Jesus, and he no doubt believed in the authority of the Catholic Church. It didn't come up in his books, but I think he had that part of his makeup from the beginning.
You're listening to Sheer Intelligence. My guest is Lawrence Ferlinghetti. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Sheer Intelligence. My guest, Lawrence Ferlinghetti.
Let me just take the beat thing up a little bit further to another story. I remember being in the store selling books in that little triangle area, clerk area. That a guy came in, and he had some friends who I knew from Minnesota, I think they were, Ivers, and I forget the other guy's name. And he was introduced as, I think he was introduced as Zimmerman, but he was already, I think, Dylan, and this Columbia record was coming out. And he said he had come to the store, to see Lawrence Ferlinghetti. And he said he wanted to thank you for having discovered him. And he said, I thought he said it was in Chicago, the Gator Horn, which is I associate with Adetta, that she sang there. But he said he was at a poetry reading, whatever they were called, and very late in the night when no one was paying attention to him, you stood up, you were the headliner, you stood up and said, "Hey, everybody, listen to this kid. He's the best poet all night."
So this is what the...
This is what he told me, as I recall. And so then he went downstairs. You were there, and you talked to him. And I think this must have been around 63, somewhere around that. I can't remember exactly.
Well, I don't have any memory of any such meeting with anybody named Zimmerman.
Or Dylan.
Or Dylan.
Really?
Not in City Lights Bookstore. What I remember is I was in the Gate of Horn in Chicago. It was the end of the evening, and he was the last man on the bill. He was singing those long, early Dylan songs, which were really long, surrealist poems, like Bob Dylan's 116th Dream. They asked me for some collateral, and I took down my pants, and et cetera. These were great poems. I don't remember ever standing up and telling everybody, "You got to listen to him. This is a great genius." I just was impressed by myself listening to it that these were really great poems, and he happens to have a guitar. He wanted to be published as a poet.
I mean, did you tell him that night? Did you talk to him?
No, I didn't have any conversation with him. Later, I was in New York and visiting my publisher, New Directions, and I came down from the New Directions offices, and Dylan was standing in the front door just hanging around. He had his guitar in a beat-up case, and he's just hanging around the doorway of New Directions. And
did you talk to him? Or?
Yeah, I had some kind of conversation about maybe he said, "How do you get up there?" or something like that. And I said, "Well, I don't know. There's the elevator. And I don't know what happened."
Let me ask you about the impact of this movement of the beats, because I know when we talked before, you said, "I'm not a beat." Was it like you were riding some wild tiger or something when you were, what were you? You were the publisher? You were one of the...
I think
you're the best-selling beat poet, aren't you? Or is Ginsberg a beggar?
I wouldn't use the word beat in there. I was a straight man.
Oh.
I was a straight man keeping the store back home. I was leading a respectable married life on Potrero Hill. These guys were much too far out for me. I didn't go on the road with them. And I came from a former generation. When I arrived in San Francisco, I was still wearing my beret from Paris. And we were known as bohemians. Bohemians is a term that was used for people who led an unconventional creative life. Before the Beats came along, then they started using the term Beats. But when I arrived in San Francisco, no one had heard of the Beats. And North Beach was a bohemian scene. So I was really a former generation.
So you actually decided to open the bookstore without having that as a particular connection, beat poetry or anything?
No, no. It had nothing to do with beat. I'd never heard of the word beat when we opened the bookstore.
Which was, what, 55? Or?
June 53.
But for people who don't know, one of the revolutionary things about this bookstore was the recognition that paperback books were going to represent a whole new era for literature.
Yeah, that was what became known as the paperback revolution, when the big publishers in New York finally started publishing quality paperbacks. And there was they were merchandised and distributed as a magazine on magazine stands, and magazine distributors didn't know what they were, and there was no place to buy these new quality paperbacks. So just by force of the whole revolution that was happening, we opened up the first paperback bookstore in the country. Then I never got back to having the used bookstore that I had in mind. I had in mind having a store like George Whitman's in Paris. Never got back to that.
Because it took off. I mean, paperbacks, yeah. Suddenly there were a lot of interesting books. So you were the first bookstore devoted to paperbacks in the country?
Yeah, and it was really Peter Dean Martin's idea. He had a little magazine called City Lights before I came to San Francisco even, and he was in having a third issue. I submitted some translations of Jacques Prévert to him, and he published them. And I was driving back from my painting studio down on the waterfront, and I was driving up Columbus Avenue, and there was a guy across the street where City Lights is now. He was putting up a sign, Pocket Bookshop. I don't know why I stopped. I parked and walked across the street, and I told him my name, and he said, oh, we published you. I published the Prévert poem. So I said, well, what are you doing? What's this Pocket Bookshop sign? He said, well, we're going to open up a little bookstore to pay the rent for my City Lights magazine, perhaps the first pop culture magazine with articles on, for instance, the sociological significance of Moon Mullins, the cartoon character, and it had the first writing by Pauline Kael, who became a famous film critic on The New Yorker.
And so you're doing this now, so it's 53, and when did the Beats come along?
Well, I guess Allen Ginsberg, bookstores are a natural place for poets to hang out, so right from the beginning, poets started hanging out at City Lights when we opened in 53, and Allen came up from Mexico about 53 or 54, and he showed me Howl, the manuscript of the poem Howl, and I thought it was really extraordinary. I never read anything like that before. I mean, that's a sign of a great work when you read something, you say, I've never seen the world like that before. I said, well, we don't have any money, but I do want to publish this book. Sort of left it at that, and then the next thing I know, he was giving a reading, which became famous, in the Sixth Gallery on Lower Fillmore Street. Maybe this was a year later after I first met him. So I went to the reading, and I didn't know him well enough to hang out with his gang, but I went there with Kirby, my wife, and we listened, and we drove back up where I was living. In those days, of course, there was no email, and there was no cell phones and so forth, so I sent him a Western Union telegram, like at midnight, saying, I greet you at the beginning of a great career. When do we get the manuscript? I stole that line, I meet you at the beginning of a great career, from what I had heard Emerson had written to Walt Whitman upon reading the first copy of Leaves of Grass. And anyway, that sealed the deal, and Allen was faithful to us as his publisher through at least six books and over 30 years. He finally wanted to have a big New York respectable publisher, so we let him go to the big collected poems published by Harper's, I believe.
So when were the police involved in the arrests and all the things?
Oh, well, that's another long story. You got another hour and a half?
Go ahead. Try me. I mean, so you published Howl.
Well, it was printed in England because paper and printing were much better and cheaper in England. And then it was stopped by the U.S. Customs in the port of San Francisco.
We should mention to people the time frame. This was a time when you couldn't have brought James Joyce Ulysses. You couldn't bring D.H. Lawrence. You couldn't bring Anacreon into the country.
No.
People would buy those books in France and then change the cover and smuggle them in.
Yeah, well, Henry Miller's Tropics of Cancer and Tropics of Capricorn, the only way you could get a copy was get the edition published in France, and they were had green covers on them. It was
Olympia or something.
Olympia,
right?
Press, published by Maurice Gerodius.
Yeah, I remember smuggling people, those.
People, they were called the Traveler's Companions series. So everyone who came back from Europe, they always had the Traveler's Companion in their luggage. So when we published Howl, it was seized by the U.S. Customs in San Francisco as being an obscene publication. But then the local U.S. District Attorney refused to prosecute. The Customs released the books. Then the Juvenile Department of the San Francisco Police Department came to the bookstore, two officers, and arrested me and Shigeyoshi Murao, my manager, for selling this book. We just put it on sale. And so then we had a big trial, and we were defended by the American Civil Liberties Union. Luckily enough, I had gone to the American Civil Liberties Union before we sent it to the printer and asked them if we got busted for this book, would they defend us? And they said yes, they would. So that was a great boon to us because we were a little one-room bookstore without any money. Al Bendick was the young lawyer trying his first case. The ACLU won the case on the constitutional grounds, whereas the prosecution lawyer spent all his time reading dirty passages of what they consider dirty. Judge Clayton Horn established a precedent which has held up all these years, even though it was only a municipal court in San Francisco. Judge Horn ruled that a work could not be considered obscene if it had the slightest redeeming social importance. And so that allowed the Grove Press to publish Lady Chatterley's Lover and Henry Miller's books and D.H. Lawrence and Jean Genet and many others. The floodgates were open.
That was that Barney Rossett?
Barney Rossett, yeah.
I remember when you rejected me, when I wrote a book about Cuba.
I didn't reject it.
He said it was too scholarly.
Well,
too big.
We got you to rewrite it, right?
Yeah, well, then we sold it to Barney Rossett at Grove Press.
Well, that was a good choice, because we were too small to publish a book of that. That at that point, we'd only published little poetry books.
Yeah, and I showed up with this, 300-page manuscript that I did with Maurice Seitlin.
Today we would have jumped on it right away because now we just published the book on the surveillance state.
Yeah, a very good book.
And these are full-size books, but we weren't capable of doing that back then.
I know, I'm teasing you. But it was nice to get rejected by you and accepted by Grove Press. And then Penguin picked it up, so it was... Good. You know, it's interesting.
It was the first pro-Fidel book in
the country. It wasn't pro-Fidel. It was a critical view of U.S. foreign policy.
Well, I would say it was pro-Fidel.
Well, no, because the title was Cuba, an American Tragedy.
Yeah, right.
And then in the Penguin was Cuba, Tragedy in Our Hemisphere. And the idea, which I think you were very sympathetic to, was that Castro had the potential of developing a democratic socialist alternative in Latin America, and that by a U.S. policy of hostility, we forced him to rely on the Soviets.
Yeah, exactly.
And that destroyed the democratic content of the Cuban Revolution.
Right.
So it was actually a cautionary tale that we're getting exactly the opposite result of the one we claim we were in favor of.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I was in Nicaragua in 1985 and in 1989, and one of those trips I was reading the Nicaraguan newspaper in Spanish. It was an interview with Fidel Castro, and he said, "I am not a follower of Moscow, I am its victim."
I'd love to get that interview. I interviewed Castro in, I think it was 68, I know it was, and Cuba had already, it was the night that the Soviets invaded Czechoslovakia. And he was all torn about this. First he was critical, and then the next day he changed his view or something. One of the things I was bugging him about, in addition to that, I didn't know too much about it, it just was happening. You talked all night long. It was very strange. And I wasn't able to take notes. That was the condition, you know. They just let's just talk, and I'm in the middle of all this stuff. I don't want to tape recorder. But anyway, I wrote about it anyway in a sort of more general way. And I remember bugging him about, or challenging him about, the UMAP camps. This place where they would round up homosexuals for re-education. And I thought about it when I was talking to you recently, that here they had been publishing, Ginsberg and others, who were homosexuals who were writers and quite open about it.
Yeah.
The Beats, everybody forgets, because, you know, it was a crime to engage in homosexual acts in San Francisco as well as in the rest of the country, certainly right into the late 60s. And so here were these Beat poets that were being celebrated in the first years of the Cuban Revolution, who visibly had homosexuals publicly open out of the closet as some of their most prominent writers. Did that ever seem avant-garde or as a big issue?
No.
Gay poets was just what, part of bohemian life? Or?
No, I don't remember it ever coming up at all.
So when Ginsberg wrote, and I thought it was in the poem,
you know, it was, think of it, Ginsberg was openly gay in the 1950s. This is extraordinary to be openly gay in the 1950s. When he came to San Francisco, he ran into the poets of what was known as the San Francisco Renaissance, and it was poets like Robert Duncan. Robert Duncan was the leading resident poet in San Francisco, and he was gay, but he wasn't out.
He wasn't out?
I mean, as far as I know.
Yeah.
Among the other poets, everyone knew he was gay, but you kept it to yourself. There was no gay parade in those days.
But Ginsberg didn't keep it to himself. He wrote America, I'm putting my queer shoulder. I think it's the first use I know of the word queer in a proud.
Yeah, I am putting my queer shoulder to the wheel.
Yeah, I mean, no, really, I mean, you can think of that as one of the early.
Yeah.
Gay rights manifestos.
It had this humor in it that sort of deflected the...
Well, but he was openly gay, in gay, you know, partnerships. I think you pointed out he had quite a few of them.
Yeah.
And yet that never came up as... I mean, it was the obscenity of using certain words rather than... I mean, it never came up as an issue?
Well, there was an issue there because I would bring it up to him about... his being evicted from Cuba, and he would never really answer. He would not dispute it. He wouldn't. But then he never really supported Fidel after that.
You were straight while you were supposedly a beatnik, and yet you wrote Coney Island of Mind.
Well, the beatnik was just a press thing from the publicists, people that laid that on us. And the beat poets hated the word beatnik. They hated being called beatniks, because this was Herb Kane, the columnist, evidently invented the term, and it was at a time when Sputnik was in the news, and so beatnik was a cool way of putting down these poets as being just beyond the pale, you know.
But you were, despite being straight, I mean, I don't mean sexually straight, but you were... No, you didn't drink.
I was definitely sexually straight.
No, I know that, but I mean, but you didn't do much drugs, as far as I know.
No, just dope.
Yeah, and yet, your poetry came to be signature poetry of the whole movement.
Well, the poetry doesn't have anything to do with any. There's no psychedelic visions in my poetry.
Yeah,
I think I did have two LSD trips, but. Both in Big Sur, and I would never think of going to of dropping acid and going to a rock dance. It would be horrible.
That's all for Sheer Intelligence. My guest has been Lawrence Ferlinghetti. The interview was taped at Sports Byline Studios in San Francisco. I want to thank my producers, Joshua Shear and Rebecca Mooney, and Mario Diaz and Kat Yor at KCRW.